If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You need to be a money or financing ninja, so to speak. And what I mean by that is I got very creative in using what was available to me.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Scott Price has been actively investing in real estate for over 16 years. He currently owns multifamily, office, retail, single family, and even land investments. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. You know, the same questions I ask everybody who comes on here is, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Sure. Yeah. I started a number of years ago, actually several decades ago, with my first small investment and had interesting experiences there where basically I bought it. It was just a single unit and eventually sold it because I thought, oh my gosh, dealing with tenants, what a pain in the butt. And I said, oh, but the real estate investing still made so much sense. And I then got basically more educated and realized, well, you know, there are processes for that. There are team members for that. There are property managers for that, things along those lines. And then I started really thinking bigger about, okay, how can I turn this into a business and not just a pastime, I would say, and really make it something that becomes my full-time income. And about 16 years ago, like you said, I started thinking bigger. I did a small development project that then rolled into an apartment complex. And that started my journey, really, always with the goal of being a full-time real estate investor, with that being my sole and primary source of income, which is where I'm at now.
And so 16 years ago, you were a full-time investor, or at what point in time did you make that transition?
Yeah, I know. When I started, and for quite a while, I was working a W-2 job, and I had different roles with different companies. My approach was, how can I grow real estate on the side, have a good team so that I'm not being called while I'm at my job, you know, to address certain things, and basically gradually build it so that I would be able to roll from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 years and so on in terms of the number of units. And there were, for me, it was a conservative approach, but it was an approach that I was comfortable with. And it allowed me to have a source of income that more than covered all my expenses. So that all the profits that I was getting from my real estate, from income and cash out refinances and things like that, that all went toward more properties. And, you know, that there was no need for me to tap into that for my personal bills, and I had good benefits and things like that. So for quite a while, I actually maintained a W-2 job. And then the long-term goal was always to be full-time real estate investor. And finally got to a point where I had a few, I guess you could say Dilbert moments, meaning I kind of said, okay, you know, I could have left my W-2 job years earlier easily. You know, I had enough income coming in from my various properties, but I really got to the point of saying, okay, after the Dilbert moments, I'm going full time now. So that was about 3 years ago that I went full time. Even though, like I said, I could have done it much earlier if I'd wanted to.
Right. That's interesting. And you know, I think that's for some way I get the feeling, especially amongst real estate investors, it's like looked down upon if you've retained your W-2 as a real estate investor. It's like you haven't done the right thing soon enough or fast enough. But I don't necessarily subscribe to that. And it sounds like for you, this was a very effective way for you to continue to be able to roll all of your proceeds from your assets and keep growing, building, like you said, building up your asset base to bigger and bigger assets without having the need to eat your profits.
Exactly. And it was a way for me to be able to roll forward without actually needing to partner. Partnering is good. I'm not saying partnering is bad, but at the same time, you know, all the properties that I own or me and the bank own, so to speak. And, but you know, it's kind of nice to have that level of control and have a committee of one to deal with.
Right. A committee of one. I'm sure at times there's the, you wish you could point the finger somewhere else, but what it would talk to us about that. I think this is a unique, you know, especially with the advent and really, you know, syndication taking off at large, talk of joint ventures, of partnering your way to success, things like that. Why have you chosen to really do everything on your own? And how can somebody emulate that? What's a good way to do that such that you don't have to deal with the rest of their investor base and everybody else to talk to? Like you said, party of one.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of it has to do with, well, there's the benefit side and then there's the how to do it side. So benefit side, kind of address that with the committee of one, and just it's a classic thing where if you own 10 units, of course I own a lot more than that, but if you own 10 units and you own it outright, that's nice. Or if you own 1% of 1,000 units in a syndication, you still own the equivalent of 10 units, you know. So right. Kind of nice that, you know, nice to actually, you know, directly control a larger share of the pie. So to be clear, actually in the future, I do anticipate getting into syndications. Hmm. And that's just to grow my business, because the limiting factor on it, of course, is you're limited by your own funds and you're limited by your own properties in terms of what kind of cash you can pull out of them. But at the same time, I had a longer range plan, and my longer range plan was to roll forward. And I did that. You know, it's turned out nicely for me. As far as how to do it, it really boils down to you need to be a money or financing ninja, so to speak. And what I mean by that is I got very creative in using what was available to me. I didn't start out with zero down. So, you know, that is an option, but I'm not saying I did. I saved up some money. I still had a lot of fun, traveled, had cool hobbies, stuff like that, but I saved. And then as I saved, then I got myself into a development deal, which allowed me to get equity, which allowed me to start with apartment complex and then start rolling things forward, could do cash out refis. I even borrowed from my 401k. I got a solo 401k so I could buy a property in my 401k and be owned by my 401k. You know, all these kinds of things. And between income and doing value adds on equity, I basically just kept staircasing upward. You know, kept doing the next rung on the ladder and just kept building. And whenever I could pull cash out or use my income stream, I would roll it forward. I've always honed in on smaller properties, meaning by smaller, I mean, you know, like in the 10 to 30 unit range. So I'm not talking about, you know, 100 unit properties and above, stuff like that. And that's been good. You know, there's a real good opportunity in that area because you're not dealing with the retail people on the low end and you're not dealing with the big institutions on the high end. And it's also more bite-sized for an individual to be able to buy them.
Right. Yeah, I like that. I've heard that a few times from some investors. You know, obviously the 100 unit plus is touted amongst the larger buyers around the country as the way to go because it, you know, economies of scale, you can bring property management in, things like that. But, you know, we're also hearing from people like yourself that smaller properties have their own advantages that maybe are overlooked.
Yeah, especially in the current environment, which is we have so much cap rate compression going on, and it's even though we have really terrific low financing in terms of interest rates and generally good terms, nonetheless, it gets hard to cash flow well, and that can be a good sweet spot in between to at least increase the cash flow. If you were to graph it out, there can be more opportunity in that middle ground for the reasons I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the types of assets that you own. I mean, I know we talked about multifamily, which I think, you know, the benefits of owning that have been well explained on this show and probably a lot of others, you know, in the podcasting space. Let's dive into some of the other investments maybe that you hold and talk to us kind of your thinking of how you got into those and what it was like investing in those. you know, Office is one right now that is obviously, you know, people are talking about the death of Office and things like that, which I just want to kind of hear what your thoughts were, how you got into it, what you see the market like now, and is there opportunity there now just based upon the absence of demand for it?
Yeah. All good points on Office and on retail, because I own that as well. And when, fortunately, again, given my somewhat conservative approach to thinking long term and not taking too high a risk, definitely doing a risk reward analysis on every property, when I have purchased office or retail in the past, I've always looked at several things, one of which, of course, is who's the current tenant or tenants. But beyond that, I'm always looking at if and perhaps when that tenant leaves, who is going to replace that tenant? And that's a whole different ballgame than multifamily in terms of how to figure that out. And you really are looking at things like parking and what the tenant improvements are, what's the visibility, what's the signage, you know, what is the traffic count by there, what's the local competition, what kind of business would even want to be there. And whereas on an apartment, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, if you get a vacancy, and even if you don't have a hot market, but there's a lot of competition and you know, higher vacancy in the market, you know, you drop the rent $25 and you get it filled. You know, that might be a bit of a generalization, I understand, but at the same time, it's not as simple. I mean, you know, you could almost offer an office for free to a business, and it still has to meet all their other requirements. So you really got to be thinking about that and analyzing not just what you buy at that moment in terms of that tenant, but you've really got to be thinking in the future. It has benefits such as long-term, and a number of a number of my properties are variations on what's called triple net. For your listeners who may not know triple net, it basically means the tenant takes care of everything in terms of maintenance as well as expenses. There are variations on that, but you know, essentially a number of my properties are like that, which is nice. And they also can be long-term leases. Most of my properties are five-year lease terms. I have one that I just got a 10-year, for instance, and that's kind of nice. But the time between vacancies can be much higher than you're accustomed to in a multifamily. So multifamily, you do a turn, you might have a week downtime and fill it, hopefully. But I had one property, it was a slow time in the market, and it was vacant for a year. It was Wow. entirely vacant for a year. And it was just because of combination of market time. And again, what I was talking about, you got to find a business who is specific to that place. You know? You know, now I have it filled, and I've got it filled for a very long time with really creditworthy tenants. So it takes a while, and then you get to coast on it for a while.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. What, you know, especially on the retail side of things, something sitting vacant for a year. I mean, you can't really underwrite that. But I mean, what did you do to cover the note on that and to just make sure that the thing stayed solvent during that period?
Yeah, in that particular case, it was actually a two-tenant building, and the other one was occupied. And essentially, the one tenant's rent paid the mortgage, and it was triple net, so they paid half of the expenses.
Right.
So the expenses to me were essentially half of maintenance kind of costs and keeping a little bit of utilities on. So it wasn't that much, but it was from personal savings. You know, I wasn't making money on that property. I was close to a few hundred dollars a month probably on negative, and it wasn't a big deal. But at the same time, until I got the second side filled, it was not generating cash flow for me, quite the opposite actually. But then now it's doing nicely again.
Right. Yeah. I think that's valuable. I mean, especially if it's even just paying for itself in that period, it's probably worth holding. I mean, obviously it's worth holding on to, but I mean, that's, what else can you hope for? I guess, when that happens, like, okay, this is paying for itself. It's not the end of the world. It will get filled and something good will come.
Yeah. It's part of the game with retail and office. I mean, unless you're in Times Square or something like that, where you just have massive demand. If you're out in smaller markets, you need a buffer, and you need that with any kind of of property, in my opinion. You know, multifamily as well. I do have reserves, and I keep them for things like that, or unexpected roofs that need to be replaced, or you know, things like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Let's hear about land. You've invested in land. What has that looked like, and what makes a good land investment?
Yeah, land. I've done several times, and overall, it's not my preference, but I've done it when I've seen interesting options. It's generally not my preference because it, of course, generates no income unless you have agriculture land, have a lease on it or something like that. So no cash flow is not very appealing, but you still are laying out cash to buy it. So it tends to be very speculative. And of course, some people make a lot of money at that. They can change the zoning or put good entitlements on it to make it shovel ready for somebody or something like that. In my case, I found interesting properties that had subdivision potential. Mm. And but I didn't subdivide them. However, what I did was I bought properties that had that from folks that were just kind of selling it as one big parcel. And then I remarketed it as, I didn't frankly want to get into the long process of platting it out and all that kind of stuff. They were basically flips, you know, right. Essentially. And so I remarketed it with the potential that it had and made difference on that potential.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I've never taken a parcel of land and like you said, gotten it subdivided, all the, you know, entitlements and everything done. That's just a game that requires a special skill set. But for you,
yeah, well, and it can be a long, long time. I did do it in one of the examples, but in the others, I just looked for potential, and it's kind of nice because then I get to make some money. But it's the classic thing of being able to leave money on the table, so to speak. In other words, there's more potential there that the buyer can get, and they can see that they have to put in the effort. But that also makes it more marketable too. In other words, I made a little bit of money, but they have the opportunity to make more money when they complete that entire process.
Right, right. Yeah, because if you can't underwrite an upside, then what's the point in doing the deal?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, unfortunately, as you well know, I'm sure in multifamily, a lot of people nowadays are buying on pro forma, which is really frustrating, but anyhow, it does exist. People do it.
They absolutely do. And let's talk about that. How are you finding deals in this environment that make sense?
Yeah, in most cases, for instance, I'm closing on a 16 unit, a 1-6 unit in a few days. And that one was briefly on the market, then it was off the market. And then a good broker connection of mine brought it to my attention that, hey, it's back, or at least it's back available, not on the, you know, open market being advertised. And so we hopped in on that. And then another one that we were working on recently, even though it's kind of up in the air, literally just last week, we were working on it real hard. We'll see if it goes anywhere. That was a 60 unit. And that one was completely off market. And that was actually through my property manager. And of course, had the broker's license. And then on top of that, he wanted to retain management of it. And he had a good relationship with his owner, seller, and he had a good relationship with me, knew I performed, knew I delivered on what I said I would do, and offered it to me first. So we'll see where that goes. So both of those were effectively off-market deals, you know, that can be important. I have looked at certainly on-market deals, and some of those just depend upon making a real offer and seeing if they go with it. Unfortunately, a lot of times there's a lot of competition and it can be hard to make them cash flow well. But if you go into smaller markets, it can be a little bit more feasible, you know, to get a more realistic cap rate to actually have some cash flow going.
Right, right. Yeah, I like that idea of smaller markets. Are there any concerns you have as it pertains to smaller markets?
Yeah, I do have minimum thresholds that I'm looking for. Because I'm a cash flow buyer, this is my primary source of income, number one. And number two, I like buying on cash flow because even if the market value goes down, I don't care, at least until I have to refinance or sell. You know, that's the only time it really matters. But if I have cash flow, then that's a good thing because I can cover all the expenses and I provides income. And so I go to some of these smaller markets for that reason, because they tend to have better cash flow. Mm. However, I'm looking at the economic drivers there primarily, at least to start, in terms of what is the base of companies that are there? Is it a one horse, a one pony show kind of thing, where they really have one big plant? And if that plant closes, then I had that. I mean, about a year ago, for instance, somebody, a broker came to me with an 18 unit that was $625,000. Oh, okay. Well, that got my attention, and I turned it down. And the reason was, it was in the, you know, it was in a town that basically there were more cows than people. And there was, and on top of that, there was one plant there. That was it. And if that plant pulled up stakes, tumbleweeds, you know, coming down the road. So
yeah, those are risks you just can't afford to take. Yeah,
and somebody, you know, somebody will buy that, and if that plant stays there, it'll be great for them. So, you know, it's just, it just didn't meet my personal criteria.
Yeah. Right, I would think there's too many other, and you're right, somebody will buy it, but for you, there's too many other possibilities or opportunities to invest that you don't have to take on that additional risk. It's like buying it in a military town.
For smaller markets, I'm also looking at momentum, meaning what's going on in the community, path of progress, what is happening right now in terms of development, and what's happening in some areas with gentrification, and, you know, things like that. What's going on there? I'm looking at it at multiple levels, not just economic, even though jobs tends to drive a lot for multifamily, but there's also, you know, what's the feel, and how's that neighborhood, and how does that neighborhood relate to other neighborhoods, and where are the growth patterns?
Right, man, this is great. You've given a lot of super helpful information, and really kind of pulled back the curtain on what you've done in your business today. And I've certainly appreciated it. It's been a lot of fun. Let's jump here. The final four. The final four questions are this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
I would jump in, and when I jump in, I mean, what I mean is, you know, actively jump in, don't stay on the sidelines. And before you jump in, be sure to have a combination of team and processes, and not just team and not just processes. If you're going to scale big, you really need to have the right people with a very consistent and well thought through series of processes on how you're going to deal with turns, how you're going to deal with vacancies, how you're going to deal with advertising, all that kind of stuff. You can give that thought if you have a team members, as well as hopefully some experience. But even if you don't have experience, you can even start putting those kinds of things together even before you have a property, just by best practices and talking to other investors, reading books, podcasts, just like yours, Sam, things like that. So, you know, I would say basically team and processes, not just one, but make sure that those two are intersecting, you know, that they're overlapping.
I like that. That's a great answer to that question. You may have just answered number two, but when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
I stay educated. And what I mean by that is there's different levels of education. One of them is kind of what's going on in the market. And I try not to be sucked into that too much, because I want to at least know the headlines, and then the headlines that are relevant. I read articles and things like that. But, you know, you can spend all day long going through reading real estate news, and it's not necessarily a good use of time. So it's kind of, you know, okay, what's relevant to understand the macroeconomic factors that are affecting real estate, and then what is important in the local communities I'm investing in. So I try to stay informed on that. And then at a broader level, I read lots of books, I listen to podcasts, and I also talk to other investors. And when I read books, I basically cycle between real estate books, business books, personal development books, and fiction. Just for variety. And I go between those four genres so that I'm getting, there's obviously a business focus there, but at the same time, I'm getting some variety. So I'm not just reading real estate books, for instance. I'm getting other things and other ideas that I can then apply to my real estate business.
Yeah, I like that. And I like that you incorporate fiction in there. I think allowing your mind to run and just enjoy a little creativity, you know, something maybe we overlook commonly. Business side of things. So that's fun. Okay. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
As of last year, I personally created and opened a community sculpture park. And it was land that I purchased about 12 years ago, originally with the idea of me building my home there. I was actually going to subdivide that one, but kind of to our earlier discussion, I was going to subdivide after I decided to not build there. I was going to subdivide it. And then I thought, no, it's just a beautiful property. It's 16 acres in an incredible area. And I said, no, I really want to preserve this. And then I just started thinking bigger. And I said, hey, I'm going to create a public park, and I'm going to make it an art and nature art park and a nature preserve. And as of October, it's open to the community now. So it's been great. Many thousands of people have been through, been getting terrific feedback on it. It's attracting a lot of visitors. So it's been a pretty neat experience.
Good for you. That's loads of fun. That's loads of fun. What to have you come back and just do an episode on what that process was like. Cause I'm sure you had to work with a lot of people in the city and planning and just, I'm sure there was a lot of legwork into getting that across the finish line. So
you're correct. Yeah.
What's the name of the park?
It's called Price Sculpture Forest, and sculptureforest.org is the website.
Oh, that's cool. I have to look that up. Price Sculpture Forest and sculptureforest.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. Scott, certainly enjoyed this. This has been great. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
The easiest way would be to go to my website, which is bonvolo.com, B-O-N as in November, V as in Victor, O-L-O.com. And on there, I have contact info. You can email me. You can call me. There's a number of ways to contact me there. I also talk about different things that we do in terms of our investing. I offer hourly coaching. I also do some debt partnering with others. So you can kind of see different things that we do there as well. That would be the best way to contact me.
Awesome. Scott, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.